at home in Corona, Long Island, New York, February 26, 1956.
February 6, 1926.
I've said that
here
with Lucille. She's
1956.
Pardon me.
That's Louis Armstrong and his wife Lucille on a home audio recording made by Armstrong on his reel-to-reel tape machine. He made hundreds of tapes and left them in his Queens, New York home, where he and his wife lived for nearly 30 years. Now the Armstrong House is open as a museum, and there's a new companion book, Louis Armstrong, The Offstage Story of Satchmo, by our guest Michael Cogswell. He's the director of the Louis Armstrong House, also the Armstrong Archives, based at Queens College, which holds Armstrong's personal audio tapes, photographs, autobiographical material, scrapbooks, and trumpets. Terry spoke with Michael Cogswell in 2001. Let's start with some music. This is West End Blues, a classic Armstrong Hot 5 recording from 1928. When Terry spoke with Michael Cogswell, she asked him about Louis Armstrong's house.
Why don't you describe the house and the neighborhood that it's in?
In 1943, Louis and his wife Lucille purchased a simple frame house in the working-class neighborhood of Corona, Queens, and they lived there for the rest of their lives.
Describe the interior of the house and what Armstrong was proudest of.
Well, although it's a very simple frame house, sort of an Archie Bunker house, if you will, they did many remarkable things with the inside. For example, they enclosed the front porch and removed some interior walls to make this gigantic living room, this 70-foot-long living room, which they filled with paintings and upholstered furniture. The downstairs bathroom is covered with mirrors. Every inch of the walls and ceiling is covered with mirrors, and all the fixtures are gold-plated and imported from Italy. So they did many fabulous things with the interior of the house.
Why did the Armstrongs live in a working-class neighborhood for the latter part of Armstrong's life when they could have afforded probably to live anywhere?
Well, it's an interesting issue because Louis, when they bought the house, was already a superstar, and they could have lived almost anywhere, perhaps in Beverly Hills, certainly a big estate on the north shore of Long Island. Lucille found the house and purchased it and decorated it without Louis ever having seen it. They were married in 42, and she bought the house in 43. Louis came in off the road. We know this from his own manuscripts. He gave a cab driver an address, "Take me to this house in Queens." They pulled up front. Louis said, "Oh, go on, man. Take me to the address I gave you." The driver said, "No, this is it." So he got out, came up, rang the doorbell. Lucille opened the door. "Welcome home, honey." She had a home-cooked meal on the table. She had the whole place decorated. And he fell in love with it. And in later years, Lucille tried to convince him to look at an estate on Long Island and a townhouse in Upper Manhattan. And he refused to even consider them. He was very comfortable there in the neighborhood. He knew the neighbors. They knew him. He would hang out on the front steps of the house and talk to neighbors. He would walk up the street to 106th Street and Northern Boulevard, Joe's Artistic Barber Shop, get his hair cut, chew the fat with the guys in the barber shop. He had a very comfortable life there, and he cherished it. It was a real refuge for him when he was off the road.
An important part of the Louis Armstrong archives is this huge collection of tapes that he recorded on an old reel-to-reel machine. What kind of things did he record on his reel-to-reel tape machine?
There are more than 650 tapes in the Armstrong collection at the archives. About half of those are simply dubs of LPs and 78s. Lewis would copy his favorite records onto audio tapes so that he could listen to them when he was in the hotel room or the dressing room. He had a steamer trunk custom modified to hold his tape decks and turntables, but he also recorded, the other half of the tapes, are spoken word tapes. He would turn his tape recorder on to record when he was hanging out in the dressing room or backstage or wherever. And as a result, we literally have hundreds and hundreds of hours of tape of Lewis and the guys sitting around swapping dirty jokes and band stories, and Lewis and Lucille at home, and you name it.
He also recorded many memories about his life. Who was he speaking to when he did that? Was he doing that for posterity?
That's a good question. Sometimes he would make tapes as spoken word letters. We know from the tape that he was making the tape for an individual. For example, Max Jones, one of his biographers in England. But other tapes, we have to ask ourselves that question. For whom was he making this? And on one level, he's just playing with his tape recorder. He's having fun with his audio equipment. But on another, more profound level, he was making it for us. He was leaving an audio legacy for us.
Well, you've brought some tape excerpts with you. Why don't we listen to one of them? And this is a memory of Louis Armstrong's from his childhood in New Orleans when he came out of the orphan's home. Why don't you summarize what's in this, because it's just a little bit hard to hear, so I think it would be easier to listen to if we already know what we're listening for.
On New Year's Eve, New Year's of 1912, Lewis fired off a pistol in the streets of New Orleans and to celebrate New Year's Eve, and his little buddies were with him. And there was a policeman nearby who saw this. Lewis had been in some minor scrapes with the law before, and he was sentenced to the Colored Waifs Home for Boys in New Orleans. And he spent roughly 18 months there. When he got out, he was released to the custody of his father. Now, Lewis's father had abandoned the family when Lewis was an infant, and he continued to live in New Orleans, but Lewis had had very little contact with him. So the story Lewis is telling is that he's released from the Waifs home, and he goes to live with his father and his father's new wife and their children.
Okay, let's hear Lewis Armstrong.
When I came out of the Waifs home, I stayed a while with my father, Willie, and his other wife and family. He had another wife named Gertrude, a nice woman. She thought quite a bit about me. She liked me pretty good. And I thought she was nice chick, you know. And I really liked her. She and my father had two boys and a girl, so I stayed with them for a while when I first got out of the Waves home. But I commenced to getting a lonesome, I got lonesome for my mother, Mary Ann. And Mary Ann, you know, that's her nickname. And my sister, Beatrice, who they call Mama Lucy for nickname. And before I realized it, I was back living with them again, and happy as could be, in that great big room where the three of us were so happily, and we lived there so happily, so very long.
Lewis's mother was a teenage prostitute when she gave birth to him. Did he ever hold that against her, that she had been a prostitute?
Louis always spoke of his mother with the deepest and most sincere respect and affection. He dearly loved her, and she was a huge influence on his life. It's funny, Louis occasionally speaks badly of his father. If you stand back a couple of steps, though, and look at the big picture, what is more likely is that his mother was on the street and was hustling, as Louis would say, and his father left her, and he had a very responsible job. He was superintendent in a turpentine factory, which for a black man in turn-of-the-century New Orleans was a good job, and he held that job for many years, and he remarried and raised children with his second wife. So his father apparently was quite stable. Louis worshipped his mother, and he did not have strong feelings for his father.
And he writes in his manuscripts that he always felt very comfortable around prostitutes, and in fact his first wife was a prostitute too.
Well, Louis grew up in a neighborhood of New Orleans that was so rough it was nicknamed the battlefield, and that's the environment Louis grew up in, is pimps and prostitutes and street people and nightlife people and gamblers, and he loved them all. He always speaks of his childhood in the most glowing terms of what a wonderful childhood he had. He and his mother and sister lived in a little two-room house with a dirt floor, and there was a privy out back, and they were so poor that occasionally Louis and his sister would go through garbage to find vegetables and so they could cut out the rotten parts and eat what was remaining. But in spite of that type of childhood, Louis always refers to his childhood with great affection.
Back now with Terry's interview with Michael Cogswell, director of the Louis Armstrong House and Archives, and author of the new book, Louis Armstrong, The Offstage Story of Satchmo.
Let's get back to the tape archives that Armstrong left. As you mentioned, he often put his record collection on tape so that he could travel with the tapes and listen to them. Sometimes he'd tape himself playing along with one of his records. And we're going to hear an example of that. And in fact, he's playing along with a record that he was featured on. Describe the story here.
This tape was recorded backstage or in a dressing room, because at the very beginning you can hear a trombone warming up in the background. And what Louis is doing, he spins on his turntable a 78 that he made with King Oliver back in 1923 called Tears. He says 22 on the tape, but we know it's 23. And then he picks up his trumpet and plays along with it. And meanwhile, he's recording the whole thing.
And what was the role that Joe Oliver played in Armstrong's life?
Joe Oliver was one of the great New Orleans trumpet players, a generation older than Louis, and he took a liking to little Louis and took him under his wing. He became Louis's teacher and mentor. And then King Oliver, well, then he was later called King Oliver when he got to Chicago. He went to Chicago and formed a band there, was very successful, and he sent for Louis Armstrong. So in 1922, Louis left New Orleans and traveled north to Chicago to join the King Oliver band. And that was a huge step for Louis, to leave his hometown of New Orleans and go to the big city up north. And it really was the launching of his international career.
Before we hear Armstrong playing trumpet with his own recording, let me just read what it is he says, because what he says is a little hard to make out. So remember, he's introducing his recording Tears that he's going to play with, and he says, "Here's one that's a beautiful thing called Tears, and we made that one for the OK recordings, and as this record plays along, I'm going to noodle a little with it, you know, for old time's sake."
You're now about to hear some of the finest incidents that'll take you way back as far as the year of 1922, when I, Lou Armstrong, was playing second trumpet with Joe Oliver at Lincoln Garden in Chicago. And also used to write a lot of tunes. Here's one that's a beautiful thing called Tears, and we made that one for the OK recordings. And as this record play along, I think I'm gonna noodle a little with it, you know, for old time's sake. Show you how the trend of recordings and everything has changed. But you'll get a good idea of this record. It's a pretty thing. Thank you.
That's Louis Armstrong from one of the recordings that he made himself with his reel-to-reel machine. My guest, Michael Cogswell, is the director of the Armstrong House and Archives. How are you dating the tapes that Armstrong recorded?
As a rule, the only way that we can date these tapes is by references on the tape to a current event or recording session or some other indication of when Lewis made the tape. We can look at the manufacturer of the tape, the type of tape it is, and get some evidence that way, but really Lewis's references on the tape are the only hard evidence we have of when he recorded it.
Armstrong also left a lot of journals. And you have those journals in the Armstrong House and Archives. Let me read you something that he said in one of his journals. And the Jewish family he's referring to here is the Karnofsky family, who we can talk about in a moment. But he says, many kids suffered with hunger because their fathers could have done some honest work for a change. No, they would not do that. It would be too much like right. They'd rather lazy around and gamble, etc. If it wasn't for the nice Jewish people, we would have starved many times. I will love the Jewish people all of my life. The Negroes always wanted pity. They did that in place of going to work. The Negroes always hated the Jewish people, who never harmed anybody, but they stuck together. And by doing that, they had success. Negroes never did stick together, and they never will. They hold too much malice, jealousy, deep down in their heart, for the few Negroes who try. Is that the kind of thing he would have said in public, criticizing African Americans like that?
He would have. We have to put that particular manuscript in context. It's a very powerful passage, and I'm not going to back off and say Lewis didn't mean it. He obviously did. But he wrote that manuscript, and he opens the manuscript by saying this. He is ill in his bed at Beth Israel Hospital. This is about 1969. So he's not feeling well. He's facing his own mortality. Plus, as he started that manuscript, before that passage that you read, Joe Glazer, his manager from 1935 on, they had made each other rich and famous. Joe Glazer had a stroke, was admitted to the same hospital, and was in a coma just a couple of floors below Lewis. The kindness of Jewish people to Lewis during his lifetime is also a factor in that manuscript. The Karnofskys were a family of Russian Jewish immigrants in New Orleans who took Lewis under their wing and really helped him, took a keen interest in him. Joe Glazer, who we said was critically ill in the hospital, and Lewis's personal physician in Beth Israel Hospital, who was tending to him at that time, was Dr. Gary Zucker. So it's a very difficult time in Lewis's life. In addition to that, we have to put it into the context of the 1960s. With the riots and the civil unrest and the assassinations. And so I think all those factors go together to make a context for that passage. That passage does display a bitterness that you don't see in any of Armstrong's other writings or tapes.
Armstrong did have some pretty powerful things to say during the civil rights movement. What are some of the statements he made?
Perhaps the most famous one is when the Little Rock crisis was unfolding. Lewis was out in the boondocks, I think North Dakota, and a local reporter knocked on his door to interview the famous Mr. Armstrong, who's in town. Lewis at that time was watching the television news broadcast about Little Rock, and he let loose with both barrels. He said that President Eisenhower was two-faced and had no guts. He called Governor Orville Faubus an uneducated plowboy. He said, the way they're treating my people in the South, the government can go to hell. The reporter wrote this up, took it back to his editor. The editor knew exactly what he had and showed it to Lewis, and Lewis approved it, wrote solid at the bottom of the sheet. It got published, it got picked up by the Associated Press, and went out all over the world. So that's the most famous statement Lewis made about civil rights. But in his dressing room tapes and in his manuscripts, you can tell that Lewis, as a rule, felt that he could do more for the civil rights struggle by being Lewis Armstrong, by performing, by knowing his fans, by traveling around the world. And that's the tact he took.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. Back with Michael Cogswell, the director of the Lewis Armstrong House and Archives. The house which Armstrong lived in with his wife Lucille for nearly 30 years is now a museum, and there's a new book associated with the museum, Louis Armstrong, The Offstage Story of Satchmo. The Armstrong Archives is located on the Queens College campus. It includes hundreds of home audio recordings he made and his autobiographical manuscripts. When we left off, Cogswell was talking about Armstrong's journals.
He also wrote about, you know, his pleasures in his journals, and one of the pleasures that he wrote about was smoking marijuana, which he did from the age of 26 on, and when he started smoking, there weren't any laws against it. He wrote, "It puzzles me to see marijuana connected with narcotics, dope and all that kind of crap. It's actually a shame."
Well, it's true. He was a lifelong pot smoker, and having said that, Lewis was also the consummate professional. He was always on time and ready to play, and one of the most creative people of this century or any other century. He would speak about his pot smoking in his writings and in the tapes, you know, just in casual references. It was no secret that he smoked marijuana. I think one of the most amusing things that comes to mind, there was a biography of Armstrong published that mentioned in passing that Mez Mezro did arrangements for the Louis Armstrong Orchestra in the 30s. And I and other people read that and said, gee, that doesn't sound right. I mean, Mez Mezro was a part-time clarinet player, but he didn't have the technical facility to do arrangements for a big band. Where on earth did that come from? Well, a couple of years ago, we acquired a copy of an Armstrong letter from the Library of Congress, a letter that Lewis wrote to Mez Mezro in the 1930s. And he says, in essence, "Dear Mez, we're doing a tour of Europe, and I need some arrangements." Now, you have to understand that Mez Mezro was Louis Armstrong's pot dealer. He says, "Mez, I need some arrangements. I need enough arrangements to last 6 weeks, and I need some really good arrangements, and I'm wiring the money to the American Express office in Paris, and you dig, Daddy, I know you'll understand." So apparently the biographer had seen this letter and not really understood what Lewis was saying.
One of Armstrong's big hits in the mid-50s was Mack the Knife, which is, you know, the Kurt Weill Bertolt Brecht song from the Three Penny Opera. And with Armstrong, it became this big pop hit. There's a recording that he made with Lottie Lenya of the song, and Lenya, by this time, was the widow of Kurt Weill. And she, of course, was in the original production of Three Penny Opera. Her style of singing is much more of a theater music style, not the kind of behind-the-beat jazz style of Armstrong. And on this recording, it seems to be Armstrong's session, and he's coaching her in the kind of rhythm that he wants. And I think it's really fascinating to listen to him control the session and coach Lenya. So I thought we could give this a listen. Anything you want to say about this track?
Well, we have tapes of this in the Armstrong archives. It is fascinating. Lotta Lenya has come by this recording session, and Lewis is coaching her on the coda, on the tag, to Mack the Knife, and she just can't get that final syncopation, and Lewis is so gracious and so patient with her. It's really a great example of these two together.
So here's Armstrong and Lenya, recorded in 1955, just a few months after he recorded his hit, Mack the Knife.
Look at your Suki Tadri,
Jenny Diver.
Look at your Lottie Lenya,
so with Lucy Brown.
Oh, the line forms on the right, dear.
Now that Mackie's back in town.
That's all right. Now all you gotta do is we straighten that. Now that Mackie's boom back in town. Then we'll pick up from there. Now we're straight now.
Good.
See, like that. Down, down, down. See, Mackie's.
That's easy for you.
It's like a phrase.
Now that Mackie's.
No, no, no. Make it 8 notes. Get Mackie's. Boom. Back in town.
Good.
Back in town. 1, 2, 3. Like that. As long as you speed this up, you know.
Now that Mackie's. Back in.
No. That's where if you say it fast, it's still straight. See, because I'm going to start blowing right over you.
Yeah.
Not that Mackie's. Boom. Back in town. 1, 2, 3.
Yeah.
That's it. Now we go right from the vocal. Come on.
Okay.
Where
you starting from?
Right, from the clan at break.
Okay, local only.
Oh, the sharp hands. Well, no, let him make it. Why don't you just start right on the clan at break? You let note out with straight.
Okay, Suki Tawdry.
Now that Mac heats. Boom.
Suki Tawdry, take two.
All the way.
No, just Suki Tawdry.
Oh, the singer. Suki Tawdry.
Jenny Diver.
Lottie Lanier.
Oh, sweet Lucy Brown.
Girl, the line forms on the right ear.
Now that Mac Keith back in town.
Suki Tawdry, take three.
Louis Armstrong and Lottie Lanier recorded in 1955. My guest is Michael Cogswell, director of the Louis Armstrong House and Archives. I want to hear another of the tapes that you brought with you from the archive. Again, this is another tape that Armstrong made himself on his reel-to-reel recording machine. And in this, he's talking about the movie High Society, which he made with Bing Crosby and Frank Sinatra. And Armstrong plays himself in the movie. He's performing for this, you know, big, expensive wedding and the wedding party. Tell us a little bit about the context of this tape we're going to hear.
Louis has just finished making the motion picture High Society. He was very proud of it. Frank Sinatra, Bing Crosby, Grace Kelly, and so forth. And he really has Louis has a really featured role in the motion picture. And he's making a tape to tell somebody, I think his manager, Joe Glazer, about making the picture High Society. And he begins to describe the opening scene of High Society, which features the whole band in a bus traveling up to Newport.
Let's hear it.
Now, for the picture, it's just made for us because we open it up with a bus scene. It's a satire on this jazz festival up in Newport. It seems as though we are in this bus going up there to play for this festival. And as we go up that road among those fine homes, you know what I mean? And that's when I start telling the boys, just think that scenery fast floating by. See? We're now approaching Newport, Rhode Island. We've been for years in variety, but Charlie Knickerbocker, now we going to be in high society. You know, that's one of the things. We're singing among ourselves. That's in the beginning of the picture. And you talking about a bunch of cats, and you know your boys, how they can ham up a thing. And they're all trying to steal that scene. Trouble young mugs so much, folks, I'm telling you. Tell even when the director was explaining the scene, he was mugging, listening.
Louis Armstrong from a home recording he made himself. The house in Queens, where he lived with his wife for nearly 30 years, is now open as a museum. Michael Cogswell is director of the museum and the Armstrong Archives at Queens College and author of the new book, Louis Armstrong, The Offstage Story of Satchmo.